From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we say goodbye to 1993 with a look back at the year's best in music and movies. Rock critic Ken Tucker and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will play some of their favorite recordings of the year, and film critic Stephen Schiff will run down his top 10 list. That's all coming up on this New Year's Eve edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A published report says President Clinton's foreign policy advisors are on the verge of recommending he end the U.S. trade embargo against Vietnam. The Washington Post reported the story today. NPR's Anne Garrels has more.
A White House official has refused to confirm the administration is close to lifting the sanctions, but he did say it was one of the options currently under consideration. American businessmen say the embargo on Vietnam is costing them dearly. They point to Asian and European companies who are free to do business and are snapping up contracts as Vietnam opens up. The key to lifting the embargo is the POW-MIA issue. When Assistant Secretary of State Winston Lord returned from a recent trip to Vietnam, he reported a high degree of cooperation on efforts to determine the fate of hundreds of Americans still missing in action. The administration must confront members of Congress and relatives of missing servicemen who are not yet reassured. Rather than tackle this politically sensitive issue now, officials have reportedly delayed making a decision until after the holidays. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The White House is trying to quiet expectations about a Monday meeting on victims of radiation experiments. The Associated Press is quoting an administration official who says President Clinton is very concerned about the matter. The official says Monday's session will be staff level only, without the president or cabinet members. The interagency meeting will feature staffers from the Departments of Energy, Defense, Veterans Affairs, and NASA. They will begin efforts to gather documents on Cold War-era experiments on humans. Some experiments were done without the subject's knowledge or consent. South African President F.W. de Klerk is condemning last night's attack on a Cape Town bar. Four people were killed. Two black militant groups are claiming responsibility. The attack is worrying people that next year's multiracial elections could be upset by violence, the BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
The question being asked openly by major political figures is whether the attack on the Heidelberg Bar and the recent racist attack by armed whites in the Transvaal are but a foretaste of much worse violence to come during the election campaign. Security sources expect extremists on the left and right of the political spectrum to increase the level of violence, and President de Klerk has called for a concerted effort to protect the democratic process. But the party which faces the greatest challenge as a result of this attack and others like it is the ANC. Within a short space of time, it will be faced with at least joint responsibility for security and will be pressed to take tough measures. And it also knows that any extremism from black political groups is likely to frighten away voters in areas like the Western Cape, where it is dependent on the support of non-blacks for victory in the crucial regional elections.
Fergal Keane reporting. The Dow lost 22 points today. This is NPR. A team of French scientists is reporting that people who live to be 100 have different genetic makeups than the rest of the population. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
The French scientists assembled a group of 338 men and women who were 100 years old or older. They wanted to see if certain variants of genes were more common in this group of people than in the general population. They found that particular variants of two genes, one called APOE and the other called ACE, were far more common in the 100-year-olds. Both APOE and ACE are thought to play a role in heart disease, and APOE has recently been linked to Alzheimer's disease. Scientists don't yet know whether these genes just keep people free from diseases that could kill them at an early age, or whether inheriting certain forms of these two genes actually make people live longer some other way. The findings are published in the current issue of the journal Nature Genetics. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
The biggest relief agency in Haiti says fuel shortages caused by the international embargo have stopped aid shipments to the northern part of the country. The relief group, CARE, says hundreds of thousands of Haitians face severe hunger or even starvation. Fidel Castro's daughter says she's grateful to the United States for helping to reunite her with her daughter. Alina Fernandez Revuelta, who defected to the United States last week, has been joined in Atlanta by her teenage daughter. The girl obtained her father's permission to leave Havana and joined her mother, who had to use a disguise to get out of Cuba. Fernandez has never been acknowledged by Castro as his daughter. She, in turn, has been a longtime critic of her father's government. Serbian gunners are blasting Sarajevo with mortar shells. They attacked the Bosnian capital today, killing at least 5 people and wounding about 38. The United Nations is blaming all warring Bosnian parties for the worsening conditions. A spokesman says all 3 sides are to blame for leaving people cold and hungry this winter. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this last day of 1993, we're looking back on the year with some of Fresh Air's critics. The pop world's biggest scandals have been making national headlines, but as usual, some of the best records don't even make it onto commercial radio. So we've asked our rock critic Ken Tucker to make up his list of the year's 10 best CDs and play us some of his favorite tracks. As usual, the list includes records that were very popular and others that were very obscure. Ken, welcome and Happy New Year.
Well, same to you. Thanks a lot.
You know, and just quickly looking over your list, I think that this is the first list in years that doesn't have a rap record on it.
Yeah, it's true. There wasn't much going on in rap music that struck me as particularly innovative musically. Certainly the dominating theme in rap music this year was taken over by the so-called gangster rappers, people like Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dogg. Dr. Dre's album, The Chronic, which featured Snoop Dogg on it, sold 3 million copies, was by far the biggest selling rap record of the year. But to me, that record and Snoop Dogg's debut album, which was called Doggy Style, these albums to me barely exist as art. To me, that the music behind them is almost entirely lifted from other records, particularly the work of George Clinton. Snoop Dogg owes his entire musical career practically to George Clinton riffs, and in particular one song, Atomic Dog, made 10 years ago. But also just the content of these albums seem to me to exist more as social documents than as any kind of artistic statements. I mean, I find it very difficult to listen all the way through an album like Doggy Style because of its kind of endless litany of casual murder and an extraordinary amount of misogyny. I just find these records so filled with loathing and self-loathing that they're just profoundly depressing. And in that, I think in a paradoxical kind of way, lies their value, because I think that this is the only place in popular culture that you hear the kind of rage and frustration and, as I say, loathing coming out. I mean, the kind of content of these records would never be heard or seen on television. Very few movies are made, and when they are, very few people go to see them about these kinds of subjects. And I think that if millions and millions of people are buying Doggy Style and Dr. Dre's record, then it really says something about what's going on in the country. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who probably buy these things the way people 20, 30 years ago bought party records. They buy them for the dirty jokes and the naughty bits. But on the other hand, I think there are a huge number of people to whom these records really speak of their daily lives. And if those are the daily lives that people are living, I find that very worrying and very very troubling. So I'm glad that these records exist on that level. On another level, they don't provide any pleasure for me and many people that I know.
Well, although none of these records made it on your top 10 list, do you want to play an excerpt of one of them just to illustrate your point?
Sure. We could play a cut from the Snoop Dogg debut album called What's My Name.
Depths of the sea, back to the block, Snoop Doggy Dogg, funky at the dot. Went solo on that ass, but it's still the same. Long Beach is the spot where I serve my cane.
Everything happening in the background there is really very catchy.
Yeah, and it's catchy because it's directly lifted from a 10-year-old George Clinton song, Atomic Dog. Clinton is on my 10 best list. He put out a really terrific album, I think, called Hey Man, Smell My Finger. Not my favorite album title of the year. But, I mean, here's George Clinton. He's over 50 years old, putting out an absolutely cutting-edge piece of music. He has enormous respect from younger rappers like Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, who guest star on that album. But Clinton's whole message is, in a sense, completely the opposite of what Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre are offering. I mean, as I said in my review here earlier this year, when Clinton invokes, say, Rodney King, he's on Rodney King's side. He really wants us, quote unquote, to all get together. Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg don't believe there's any kind of hope of us all, everybody uniting together anymore in this country. And, you know, that's part of what I see as a really depressing development.
George Clinton's new record is on your 10 best list. Is there something you want to play from it?
Yeah, I think we should play the single, the failed single from this album, a really good cut called Martial Law. It's gonna take time.
That's George Clinton. His new album is called Hey Man, Smell My Finger. Ken Tucker is with us, and he's put together his list of the 10 best pop records of the year. Ken, let's move on to country music. Anything excite you in the world of country music this year?
Well, a fair amount did. I mean, once again this year, country music continued this kind of juggernaut popularity that it's developed primarily through Garth Brooks. Billboard, in its year-end issue, reported that Garth Brooks and Janet Jackson sold more records than anybody else in any genre of pop music. Garth Brooks' release this year, which was called In Pieces, I didn't find particularly compelling. To me, it seemed like the kind of big, overreaching superstar product that an act like that puts out when you've reached that kind of mass saturation. You put out something that will offend no one and please everyone. So to me, it was a kind of bland piece of work. In fact, there's a new release by the Texas swing band, Sleep at the Wheel, that features a lot of big-name guest stars, and one cut features Garth Brooks on it. And he's singing a Bob Wills song, and I'm telling you, it's better than anything I've heard him record before because he sounds much more relaxed. But in any case, I think that country music, I was more enthusiastic about country music a couple of years ago when this kind of new generation of so-called new traditionalists first came out, Randy Travis and Alan Jackson and people like that, because it seemed to me that it was returning to the roots of country music. It was much more hardcore. It was much less pop-influenced. But lately, like so many innovations like that, it's become codified and formularized. And I think that Nashville, just by instinct, is a very conservative town, and it's led to a lot of conservative music this year. And this year, the country music that I like is frequently not quite as popular as a Randy Travis or a Garth Brooks has become. The most popular country album that I really thought was terrific was Dwight Yoakam's collection called This Time. I just think it's a wonderful throwback to a kind of 50s and 60s country sound with Yoakam's really ironic, very literate sensibility in the lyrics and the way to approach a song.
I tell myself each morning that we're through. But every night not true. I run out and track her down just so I can hang around and cry. And this time
Another country record that made it onto your 10 best list, if you want to label him as country, is Willie Nelson.
Yeah. At the beginning of this year, Willie Nelson put out this album called Across the Borderline, which really crossed all kinds of borders in terms of what it had on it. It had a duet with Bonnie Raitt. It covered Paul Simon's Graceland. I mean, when I first picked up this thing and saw that Willie Nelson covering Graceland, I thought, oh, this is going to be so corny. Instead, it was beautiful. It's a kind of recording that Willie Nelson can make when he's really good, that he seems totally assured that any kind of material that comes his way, he can make his own. I think it's a beautifully done record.
Do you want to play something from the new Willie Nelson album?
Yeah, I'd like to play that duet with Bonnie Raitt called Getting Over You.
You gotta believe that there is a reason that we surrender up our hearts. But there's a vantage point, and it takes some time to find, where you can see how all the pieces fit as you watch them fall apart.
And other people say, stop living in the past.
But when there's nothing left, it's your memory that lasts.
It's later than you think, and still, this isn't through.
This getting over you.
Now it's later than you think.
We're listening to music from rock critic Ken Tucker's 10 Best List. And Ken, why don't we take a short break, and then we'll be back and talk some more and play some more music.
Very good.
This is Fresh Air. Back with rock critic Ken Tucker, who's brought his 10 best list and some of the records on that list. Ken, let's move on to some of the singer-songwriters who've made it onto your list.
Yeah, this year, a woman named Liz Phair really made a big splash with her first album called Exile in Guyville, which was kind of this young woman's answer to the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street. Liz Phair is this as different from a gangster rapper as you could imagine, a white upper middle class woman from Winnetka, Illinois, decided to strap on a guitar and write these really terrific, aggressive songs about love and sex and problems about all sorts of things in her romantic life. I think she's really terrific, and the cut I'd like to play is a song called Never Said. By contrast, another record that I liked a lot, which didn't make the splash that I wish it had, was a record by Juliana Ray, another debut album. It was called Something Peculiar. It's inexplicable to me how a record like this, which just seems to burst with inventiveness and energy. And Juliana Ray is this woman from New York who relocated to Los Angeles, did this record with Jeff Lynn from Electric Light Orchestra and Traveling Wilburys producing it, and it just has this really bright pop-filled melodies, very Beatle-influenced, and to me, I can't imagine not hearing this thing on radio and just tapping your toe as you're driving along. The cut I'd like to play is a really good song called Tell Me I'm All Right.
Lasts for very long, and all my plans are just
That's Juliana Ray. Ken, are there any other albums on your 10 best list that are unpopular choices where you feel like a lone voice?
I got a million of them, Terry. In particular, I have David Berwald, who put out an album called Triage, not the most commercially inspired title either for an album. David Berwald has a little bit more of a track record than the other people I've been playing immediately before this. He put out a couple of records as a duo called David and David, which had a kind of cult following in L.A. But this album, Triage, it's like the work of somebody who's spent a lot of time, too much time in his room reading the New York Times, The Nation, and maybe, you know, has a subscription to In These Times and doesn't date a lot, you know. So he's consumed with conspiracy theories, evil in the world, seeing connections where they may or may not exist. And the song I'd like to play from this album is called The Waiter, and you'll really see this kind of theme emerge in the refrain, am I alone in this? Am I alone? And I think Berwald really does think he's alone in this.
Good evening, sir, madam. I would like to introduce myself. I'll be your waiter and your friend for the evening. My only purpose is to serve. And if I might observe, madame is looking quite spectacular this evening. If I might suggest, the trout is very, very fresh, and the chef is taking pains with the sauces, and the pastries are divine, and we have a special wine brought directly back from Paris by our bosses. Am I alone in this? Am I alone? Am I alone in this? Am I alone? I am your waiter. I'm ordinary. I'm the wildest in the world.
Well, I'm surprised waiters across the country aren't singing that.
I know, it's great. It's like hearing somebody have a nervous breakdown.
It's really, while you're trying to eat.
That's right.
Well, as we said earlier, there are no rap records in the strictest sense of the word on your 10 best list this year, but you do have a hip-hop record.
That's right. Yes, this group, Tony out of Oakland, California, put out this terrific album that really combines both pop melodies, rapping. The album itself is called Sons of Soul, and it really shows how they are influenced by 60s and 70s soul. I thought it was just a really terrific record that showed their range in a way that none of their previous recordings had done. The cut I'd like to play is the hit single from the album called If I Had No Loot.
There's one record on your 10 best list that has roots in the punk new wave era.
It's true. Pear Ubu is this band that came to prominence at least a decade ago around the time of punk and new wave. They sort of had their moment in the sun where, you know, if they were ever going to make a commercial impact, it's already come and gone, yet they keep putting out good records. I feel badly for them because now it's like they're not even critics' darlings anymore, and yet they put out this really good music. Pear Ubu is led by David Thomas, who has this really quirky, kind of high-pitched, wobbly sort of voice. But over the years, he's learned more and more interesting ways to make that kind of voice accessible and catchy in itself. And I think this is one of the best things they've ever done. It's an album called The Story of My Life, and I'd like to play the title cut.
I was born in Miami, Florida, 1953. First thing I did was crack the back of my head on the floor.
I stepped on a bee when I was four. I slammed the door of a 57 Chevy on my hand when I was six. Little did I know that darker clouds were gathering on the horizon of my life. That's the story. That's the story. That's the story. That's the story. That's the story of my life.
That's Pierre Ubu. Well, Ken, we've only had time to hear just some of the records on your 10 best list. What I'd like you to do is actually just run through the whole list. So if people want to get out their pens now, it would be a good time if you want to jot down everything that's on the list.
Sure. In no particular order, my list is among the records that I did not play. Loudon Wainwright's Career Moves, his live album. Nirvana's album, In Utero. And the rest of the list is Juliana Ray, Something Peculiar, Willie Nelson's Across the Borderline, David Berwald's Triage, Tony's Sons of Soul, Dwight Yoakam, This Time, Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville, Pear Ubu's The Story of My Life, and George Clinton's Hey Man, Smell My Finger.
Do you have a worst album of the year?
Yes. Frank Sinatra's Duets album. I cannot believe how overhyped. It's like some sort of mass hypnosis going on at the populace at large. I mean, do you remember a time when it was okay, you didn't have to say you were a Frank Sinatra fan, you know? And now I feel like it's a requisite, even among rock critics, where you have to say, oh, Frank, you know, he's classic. No matter what he does, that duet with Bono, oh, it's classic. To me, it was just like these phoned-in dead performances. I really thought that this record was dead on arrival. I'm stunned that it's the success it is.
Well, Ken, it's been fun looking back on the year in pop. Thanks a lot for being here, and I wish you a very happy new year.
Well, same to you, Terry. Thanks a lot.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. He writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's music from Ken's pick for the worst album of the year.
I have got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me.
So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin.
I have tried so not to give in. I have said to myself, this affair never gonna go so well.
But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well
that I've got you under my skin. I would sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of holding you near, in spite of a warning voice. Comes in the night, it repeats and shouts in my ear.
Don't you know, blue eyes, you never can win.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What's New Year's Eve without a countdown? Coming up on Fresh Air, we continue counting down the best of the year. Film critic Stephen Schiff stops by with his 10 best list. Then classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays some of his favorite recordings from the year, including some long-lost performances and some new ones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The White House will hold a meeting on Monday about the recent revelation that the government conducted radiation tests on Americans in the 1940s and 50s. Officials are trying to downplay expectations for the session, saying that staff from several departments will participate, not cabinet members or the president. A spokesman adds it's premature to talk about compensation for the victims. Meanwhile, the Department of Veterans Affairs has announced an investigation into the radiation experiments. The department wants to know whether patients at VA hospitals were improperly used in nuclear medicine research. The probe comes after the Departments of Defense and Energy announced their own reviews of the radiation tests. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin today accused PLO chief Yasser Arafat of trying to back away from a compromise that would allow the peace agreement between the two sides to go into effect. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Israel says it reached a compromise agreement with the PLO in talks in Cairo this week that would allow Israel to begin withdrawing from the Gaza Strip and the town of Jericho. The PLO says there was no compromise, only an Israeli proposal. Yasser Arafat has sent Israel a counterproposal. Prime Minister Rabin accused Arafat of trying to extract more concessions from Israel and said Israel isn't going to compromise on basic issues of security. He said further negotiations on what has already been agreed to is nonsense. Rabin said time is on Israel's side and it will not begin implementation until it has a satisfactory agreement. If that means a delay of a few weeks, Rabin said, so be it. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
The North American Free Trade Agreement takes effect at midnight tonight. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City that the prospect of NAFTA is causing some last-minute jitters there.
The uncertain mood here on the eve of NAFTA's startup was portrayed in a cartoon today in Mexico's leading financial newspaper. It shows a besotted Mexican waking up after a night of drunken revelry to a banner proclaiming, "Welcome to the first world of NAFTA." Most Mexicans don't seem to know what NAFTA will mean for them, but there's a general fear that a lot of jobs could be lost here before NAFTA starts to pay off. The government has emphasized that 80% of the goods Mexico exports to the United States will go duty-free as of tomorrow, whereas duties will be dropped on only 43% of what Mexico imports from the U.S. Most of these duty-free American imports are industrial goods. Mexico aims to raise worker productivity levels by acquiring cheaper technology from the U.S. and Canada. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials were down nearly 22 points to close at 3754.09. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 2 to 1. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin gave a brief New Year's address today in which he promised to defend Russian citizens in the former Soviet states. "Dear fellow countrymen," Yeltsin said, "you are inseparable from us and we from you." The Commonwealth of Independent States recently rejected Yeltsin's requests for special treatment for ethnic Russians. Right-wing politician Vladimir Zhirinovsky has made the issue a central part of his platform. The new year will bring in dozens of new laws across the United States. In Illinois, many new measures are designed to crack down on crime. John Dempsey of member station WBEZ reports from Chicago.
265 new laws will take effect in Illinois in 1994, including one that would allow the death penalty for people who mastermind urban street gangs and criminal drug conspiracies. In addition, murderers who torture their victims could also face the death penalty. Illinois is also increasing the maximum prison term for second-degree murder from 15 to 20 years. Other new laws in Illinois would tighten disclosure requirements for people who lobby state officials and members of the legislature. Judges would be barred from imposing a sentence that requires defendants to be implanted with Norplant or any kind of birth control device. The Illinois mandatory auto insurance law will be made permanent, and there are new restrictions on telephone solicitors. For National Public Radio, I'm John Dempsey in Chicago.
Many cities around the country tonight are holding first night celebrations for New Year's Eve, festivals that feature the performing arts and food, but no alcohol. Several areas are also offering free cab or bus rides for people who don't want to drink and drive. The head of Nicaragua's Sandinista Army indicated today he may run for president in 1996. In a TV interview, General Humberto Ortega said he might participate in some manner in the electoral effort. Ortega is widely seen as a symbol of continued Sandinista power in Nicaragua, despite the party's losses. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Happy New Year. We're looking back on 1993 with Fresh Air critics. And I don't know about you, but the year in movies is kind of a blur to me now. So here to put the year into focus, as far as movies, is our film critic, Stephen Schiff, who has, of course, made up his 10 best list. Stephen is also critic at large for The New Yorker magazine. Stephen, Happy New Year and welcome.
Same to you, Terry.
So why don't we start with your countdown?
Well, let's do it backwards so that the suspense will kill our listeners out there. Number 10, I put Much Ado About Nothing, Kenneth Branagh's version of the Shakespeare play, which was bursting with life and energy and fun. Number 9 was In the Line of Fire, which I thought was the action movie of the year. Some people would have said The Fugitive. I thought that In the Line of Fire, Wolfgang Peterson's movie with Clint Eastwood and John Malkovich, had a lot more kind of depth and richness and a kind of primal nature to the conflict that really touched me. And Clint Eastwood gave a beautiful, beautiful performance in it. And Malkovich was sort of an embodiment of evil, the likes of which we rarely get in the movies. Number 8, The Snapper, which may not yet have come to a theater near you. It's Stephen Frears' very small-scale, very funny domestic comedy about a Dublin family and a pregnancy therein, written by Roddy Doyle from his own novel, and with wonderful performances, particularly by Colm Meaney, a wonderful Irish actor whom you'll recognize the moment you see him as the put-upon father. Number 7, Menace to Society. The brilliant debut film by 21-year-old twins, Alan and Albert Hughes, and written by a 23-year-old named Tiger Williams, a really searing portrait of ghetto life in Los Angeles and one that really, in a way, fights violence with violence. You come out of the movie devastated and frightened and maybe ready to take some kind of action. Number 6, Shortcuts, Robert Altman's controversial sort of epic, with a cast of zillions and a zillion stories interwoven in the Altman style. Some people found it a downer. I found Altman's ability to make connections with all these stories absolutely exhilarating. Number 5, The Piano, Jane Campion's heralded film starring Holly Hunter and Harvey Keitel and Sam Neill, a movie that probably is a bit overrated now, but its overrating should not obscure its dreamlike beauty and the power of its grip on a viewer. Number 4, another movie that may not have opened everywhere yet, Naked by Mike Leigh, which is a really kind of scarifying and difficult and painful look at a misfit of genius in contemporary London, that misfit played beautifully by David Thewlis in probably the best acting performance I saw this year. Number 3, The Age of Innocence, Martin Scorsese's adaptation of Edith Wharton with Daniel Day-Lewis, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Winona Ryder, a film that I thought was true both to Wharton and to Scorsese, which takes some doing, and I thought it was breathtakingly passionate and beautiful, and contrary to some opinions, not at all boring. Number 2, 6 Degrees of Separation, which is slowly opening everywhere, Fred Skepsy's adaptation of John Guare's great play. And finally, number 1, probably not a surprise to a lot of people, Schindler's List, Steven Spielberg's masterpiece, a breakthrough, with a superb screenplay by Steve Zaillian and wonderful performances by Liam Neeson, Ralph Fiennes, Ben Kingsley, and a very large cast.
Interesting list. Stephen, were you surprised by Schindler's List? Surprised that Spielberg pulled off a serious film to your satisfaction?
I was completely surprised by Schindler's List, not because I thought him an incapable filmmaker. He's a great filmmaker, but he's never shown this degree of seriousness and this breadth of artistry. you know, the word on Spielberg has been that for years he's been trying to grow up, and with movies like The Color Purple and Empires of the Sun and Always. And The Color Purple, I think, is laughable and really a mess. And I think Empire of the Sun has wonderful things in it, but doesn't all hold together. Schindler's List, in that sense, comes from nowhere. It's a work of really astonishing maturity, a work of real kind of deep understanding. It has all the force of the greatest European art films, but it's told with an American energy and sort of urgency that really sends it along. Beautiful, beautiful black and white photography, which is also a very daring thing for him to do. Really mature, wonderful performances. It's hard to say where it came from, but it's a work of such passion and such anger that it really feels heartfelt and personal, and is the great Holocaust film, documentaries excluded.
Stephen, I think it's time for us to take a short break, so let's do that, and then we'll talk some more about the year in film. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff, and we're looking at the year in film. Were there any formulas that continued to pay off this year or didn't do as well as they did in previous years?
Well, the heartening news is that most of the things that had always worked before stopped working this year.
And that is good news, isn't it?
I think it's great news. I mean, one of the horrible tendencies of recent years I'm afraid it's going to continue because there are already films along these lines in the pipelines, but movies based on television shows. I mean, this we need. But the Beverly Hillbillies flopped. The Coneheads flopped. Adam's Family Values is doing not very well. Wayne's World 2 is doing not very well. So maybe even though the Flintstones are coming along, and believe it or not, I think someone is making Car 54, Where Are You, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Even though this is all happening, I think this is a trend that the box office itself will militate against. And sequels in general have not kept up with expectations. Sister Act 2 was a flop. RoboCop 3 was a flop. Look Who's Talking Now, I guess it was called, is Look Who's Talking 3. That was a flop. Another stakeout will not give rise to yet another stakeout. And as I said, Adam's Family Values and Wayne's World 2 are doing disappointing business. So maybe it means that sequels will not be such a surefire thing, and therefore they will not be necessary. And maybe people will have to come up with brand new movies instead.
Wow, yeah. What about the stars who are supposed to be sure things at the box office?
How about that? I mean, Schwarzenegger was the most conspicuous flop in The Last Action Hero. Mel Gibson flopped in The Man Without a Face, although a lot of people say, well, that wasn't a real Mel Gibson movie. And, of course, it isn't one of the rules of stardom that a star is only a star when he's in character. In other words, John Wayne was always going to be a star if he was in a war movie or if he was in a cowboy movie. But you put him in The Barbarian and the Geisha as a diplomat, and he's gonna flop. So similarly, Mel Gibson with half his face gone is really not the same Mel Gibson we know. However, Clint Eastwood and Kevin Costner have done very disappointing business in A Perfect World, for instance. Maybe there are no rules anymore except Tom Cruise.
And this is the year Harvey Keitel becomes a sex symbol.
Yeah, that's right.
Stephen, did you see the New Yorker cartoon?
Which one?
There's a New Yorker cartoon where a middle-aged couple is getting dressed for a dinner party or something.
Yes,
and the woman turns to the man and she says, "If Harvey Keitel is at the party, I'm telling you, you're on your own."
I know. It's beautiful.
Well, this is the year that President Clinton spoke to big movers and shakers in Hollywood and basically asked them to try to tone things down on violence.
I know. You know, the violence debate has been going on in movies and TV for decades now. I see very little progress being made. I see the same arguments being made over and over. And I think that you cannot take seriously a Congress that wants to militate against violence when it's not going to militate against handguns and semi-automatic weapons. In other words, if you can't ban handguns and semi-automatic weapons, and you want to ban pictures of handguns and semi-automatic weapons, it's going to be very hard to take you seriously.
I'll confess that this was the year of the GATT talks, and I found the GATT very difficult to follow. But at the very end of GATT, my ears perked up because suddenly it was about the film industry.
Well, that's right. This is a little complicated, but the controversy was that American films dominate movie theaters all over the world, and that includes in Europe. There are complicated tariffs and tax provisions that are involved with American films that the American film industry has found oppressive. It means that only a certain number of, for instance, screens, a certain percentage of screens, a certain amount of TV time can be devoted to American product. And Hollywood wanted to open up those markets and free them of tariffs. I am, in principle, anti-protectionist all the way down the line, except on this one issue. I actually do think that the protests of very respectable people like Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese aside, we need to actually control the domination of American film product over European, because otherwise you will just simply wipe out these film industries. And although at the present moment there may not seem a very strong argument to maintain the existence of the French film industry, believe me, one of these days there will be. And for it to be wiped off the map, which we do have the economic power to do, would be a real shame. So that is the one sort of place where the little demon of protectionism rears its head in my consciousness.
While we're on the subject, any really exciting foreign films that you remember from this year?
No. Unfortunately, I thought this was really a very bad year for foreign films, for foreign language films we're talking about. Farewell, My Concubine was a very worthy, well-done, beautifully made sort of soap opera, I thought, and was interesting in that respect. Il Ladro di Bambini was a also worthy, well-made, somewhat sentimental, but very thoughtful film from Italy. I enjoyed the Finnish / French production La Vie de Bohème, which was Aki Kaurismäki's version of the La Bohème story, which was a very cracked version of the La Bohème story, which I liked. It's a relatively old movie from Hong Kong, Hard Boiled by John Woo. It's a crazy action movie, and talk about a lot of violence that would probably never, ever give rise to imitative violence on the street, because no one could possibly begin to accomplish that. But that was a movie I enjoyed. These are not distinguished films, however, and I think this is not a distinguished year for foreign film. But that's no reason to squelch entire industries through the cessation of tariffs.
Any exciting performances from newcomers, directors or actors, that you saw this year?
Yes. I mean, the most amazing newcomer of the year is a guy named Leonardo DiCaprio, who was the star of This Boy's Life, a film that I thought was very, very good and probably would have made my top 10 list, except that Robert De Niro's performance in it was so heavy-handed. But this kid was fantastic, the best child actor that we've seen in a very long time. And then he turns up again in What's Eating Gilbert Grape in an entirely different sort of role. I thought that Richard Linklater, who made Dazed and Confused, that was not a perfect movie, but it kept at least 20 different characters spinning sort of gracefully in the air and created a perfect portrait of American high school life in the sort of dope-hazed 70s. I thought that this guy's skill made him look like a sort of precocious young Altman, and this is only his second film. Along the lines of somewhat more seasoned prose, I thought Groundhog Day, with its beautiful performance by Bill Murray, was a movie that shouldn't be overlooked. It had a premise that could have been merely silly, but it became almost metaphysical without losing any of its comic punch. I thought the directing job that Brian De Palma did in Carlito's Way, which was not really a very good movie, but it was so stunningly directed, especially the sort of action and atmosphere sequences, and that made it worth looking at again. And it had a great performance by Sean Penn. That's on my wish list, by the way. More Sean Penn acting, not directing.
Uh-huh.
And maybe after this year, I want to say more Robert De Niro directing, not acting, after A Bronx Tale. And no more movies, please, in which Keanu Reeves recites Shakespeare.
Well, I wish you a very happy New Year.
Same to you, Terry.
And thanks for being with us.
Bye.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic and critic at large for The New Yorker magazine. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, North Korea has agreed to some inspection of nuclear sites, but U.S. officials are skeptical. Richard Harris will sort out what's new from what's not about radiation experiments. The Chicago Tribune has run a series of stories this year on the front page about the murders of children. Ed Lifson will have a report on that. Children of war are finding peace at a school in Hampstead in North London, but they also are finding homesickness and loneliness. Daniel Pinkwater tells us the story of Uncle Boris, who explored the Klondike. And we go back to some of the people we spoke to in 1993.
Some of classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz's favorite performers, past and present, had records out this year, but they didn't all get the attention Lloyd thinks they deserve. Here's his list of some of the unsung releases of 1993.
In my book, the most expressive instrumentalists of this century are pianist Artur Schnabel, violinist Joseph Sigetti, and cellist Pablo Casals. The three of them never made a recording together, but back in 1948, Schnabel and Sigetti did a concert tour, and their recital at the Frick Collection in New York was preserved from a radio broadcast. The British label Pearl has issued the complete concert, two Beethoven sonatas and Mozart's E-flat violin sonata, K-481, which has one of Mozart's most heartbreaking slow movements. This is the most extraordinary chamber performance I've ever heard, a profound, endlessly surprising, and riveting conversation between two of the most humane voices in the history of music. Four years later, Sigetti and Casals made their only chamber music recording together, Brahms' Second Piano Trio, with Dame Myra Hess at the piano. It was already out of print when I started collecting records. Sony has finally reissued it in its hard-to-find Masterworks Portrait CD series. I don't know a richer sound than Sigetti and Casals playing together. Some long-lost performances by another great pianist, Glenn Gould, have turned up on Sony's Glenn Gould edition. Gould's deeply touching set of English Renaissance music by William Byrd and Orlando Gibbons is a special treasure. Lots of recordings by my favorite living conductor, Pierre Boulez, have been released this year. New performances on Deutsche Grammophon made with a dazzling new recording process. And his marvelous Schoenberg recordings from the 1970s. Listen to Boulez before you make up your mind to hate Schoenberg. But best of all are his live Mahler performances with the BBC Symphony. Boulez never made a commercial recording of a complete Mahler symphony, but on the Artists Live Recordings label, you can now hear why Boulez's Mahler is legendary. His Mahler Third is an overwhelming apocalyptic vision, yet it's also one of the tenderest Mahler performances I've ever heard. Heavenly in a more chaste way are the six-part motets of Heinrich Schütz. The recording on Koch International by Craig Smith and the wonderful Emmanuel Music Chorus is perfect music for this holiday season. Less popular than Handel's Messiah, but perhaps more deeply spiritual. Here's Schütz's sublime version of I Know That My Redeemer Liveth. What a privilege it is to hear the very greatest music performed on the very highest level. I wish I had time to play you all the recordings by these artists to come out this year. Both the Music and Arts label and Pearl have added to the list of live recordings of Schnabel and Sighetti. Sony's Glenn Gould edition and numerous Boulez releases should provide pleasure well beyond the new year. Happy holidays.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Well, that's about it for us until next year. Happy New Year from all of us at Fresh Air, our producers, technical crew, assistants, and pinch hitters. Happy New Year from Danny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, Dorothy Farabee, Roberta Sharrock, Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblitis, Richard Parker, Ron Barron, Chris Fraley, Bob Alls, Nancy Greenlease, Peter Clowney, Sue Spolin, Sue Weinstein, Louisa Shafia, Devin Reif, Chris Bergen, Fred Landerl, and Marty Moscowane. We hope 1994 is healthy and peaceful, with plenty of good laughs and hopefully some good movies to see. I'm Terry Gross. Talk to you next year.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Charles Strauss tells us about writing the songs for Bye Bye Birdie, Golden Boy, Annie, and now the sequel, Annie Warbucks. Also, we meet actor Nathan Lane, who starred as Nathan Detroit in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls, and is now back on Broadway in Neil Simon's new comedy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.